between kids, it's a big problem. And I remember my dad used to do that with me as well when I was young. He used to compare me. I was like, oh, look at this kid in your class. He's very smart. This. Right. He always got high marks. Why aren't you? So my dad, I'm pretty sure my dad would have done it for the right reason. He thinks it was just a form of encouragement.
Right.
But in fact, it was devastating for me. It's like,
ruins
like,
your self-esteem
like,
a lot.
I'm like, is that, you know, I must be like so dumb that I can't measure to this kid.
Right. Let's go ahead and take a quick break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing the issue of comparing and measuring your children to other people's children or even to their siblings. Dear Saeed, please pick up where you left off.
And therefore, when we ask parents, we say to them, why are you comparing between kids? They say, no, we don't compare. We're trying to encourage. We're trying to get them to be like the same. Right. But that's actually not right. We see that the reason that sometimes when it comes to parents themselves, when they have kids of their own or compared with other people and they look at other kids and they say their level of success that other people have and other kids have, they themselves, they feel the lack and they try to make it into their children. So they want to their children to have what they like. For example, you see a lot of people saying to the child, no, you have to be a doctor. You have to be something that they could not achieve.
Right.
So they have to...
They're making their children accomplish the goals that they themselves wanted to accomplish.
Exactly.
So live my life, basically.
Exactly. So, and the child, obviously, he has his own capacity. Right. I mean,
he's own interests.
And or interests or hobbies or skills. He's not like you.
Right.
I mean, he could not do it. Why do you think he can? You know what I mean?
You have no right to expect that of him.
Yeah. So we say that we cannot do that. And even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Quran, لَا يَكَلِّفُ اللَّهُ نَفْسًا إِلَّا وُسْعَهَا. Allah will not give a soul more than what it bears. So why should you? Right?
Right.
If this is his capacity, that is his capacity. There's nothing he can, it could be done.
Right, yeah.
You just have to work with them and encourage them. And if you want to increase their knowledge and their smartness and their study and what have you, all you have to do is just put a bit of effort yourself into them. Teach them, work with them, bring them tutors. I don't know.
That's now a good thing about children. Like, whatever you give, you're going to receive. It's not a failing business.
Exactly.
It's a win-win situation.
Exactly. So it takes a long time, but it doesn't mean... I remember one of the Quran teachers, he teaches kids memorization. He said he went to some family and they had two boys. And the parents said, these guys, they're just stupid. They just don't learn anything. And he said, I came with the boys. I tried. He said, I could tell they're having difficulties, trying to stay focused and memorizing the words.
Of course.
So I said, what I did is I changed the method. I said to them, let's play a game of hide and seek or some sort of game. I can't remember, tunnels or something. And whoever sees anyone, he says this ayah, like inna atainaka al-kawthar, if you see me, right?
Yeah.
And they playing around, so
I didn't give up.
Yeah. So the kids, now it's a game, so they had to memorize. They had to memorize the words.
Yeah.
So every time you see me,
just like they memorize the rules of the game.
Exactly. So now this is the rule that you see me, you have to say inna atainaka al-kawthar. He automatically says, like in a matter of like less than an hour, they memorize a couple of chapters of the small ones in the Quran.
Right.
So, and the parents, they thought, what? My child is stupid. My children are this. Some other students, look at this kid. He just memorized 30 chapters of the Quran. Well, obviously, I mean, the capacity is different.
The environment is different.
Yeah. And sometimes maybe this kid's father, they've been encouraging him, giving him a head start, helping him out.
Right. And you caring about their studies.
Yeah, and you haven't. So we say, no, that should not happen. And we're saying, no, that should not happen. And what you should do is work with the child rather than try to compare him to other students.
Right. And with that, let's go ahead and take a break.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Love children, be kind to them, and whenever you promise something to them, fulfill it."
Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing why you shouldn't compare and measure your children to other children. Dear Sayyid, please pick up where you left off.
Now, if a person needs to compare his child to another and tell that to him face to face, first has to be done in a quiet manner, in a nice, simple manner, if you want to encourage him, right? You don't come to him angrily and, you know, say this kid is much smarter than you, this and that. Right. That actually makes you hate that kid.
Right.
You know, in my case, back in the day, obviously not now, back in the day when my father used to compare me to this kid in my school, I hated that kid.
Yeah.
I hated him.
You feel hatred.
Not I hated him because he's smart. I hated him because he's the reason my dad is swearing and yelling at me.
He was the perfect child in my dad's eyes.
He's the reason I'm suffering. I was like, if he did not exist, my dad would not be angry with me.
Right.
So it causes us what? A friction between people. It makes you hate your siblings or hate other people. So as a parent, if you want to compare, you encourage them. You can say to them, look, I want you to be smarter than Fulan. I want you to be smarter as Fulan. You know, in a nicer, comfortable manner, so he understands that you are not trying to...
You should say, like, you're my child, I love you, I know you, have the capacity, I know that you have the ambition. Start off that way.
Yeah.
Do not just say, look at that dude.
Exactly. Or at least sometimes they use stories, you know, like stories of people
who
are different, whether it's be it about kings, be it about imams, be it about different people.
About hard work, about ambition.
Yeah. So they do that, and through the story, you can educate your child, you can get to him, instead of just you calling him names and saying to him, you're lazy and Fulan is better than you, and he's like this and he's like that.
Right.
That should not happen. I mean, even with us as grown adults, we still don't like to be compared to other people. If I do something and they come to me...
Like, I'm not him.
I mean, we still have this as a grown-up. I mean, if someone comes to me and says to me, you're a bad lecturer. Fulan is amazing lecturer. Why can't you be like Fulan? And some people do that. They're like, why don't you be like this? I'm like, dude, he has his method. I have my method. So sometimes people still do that. Instead of, for example, someone, if he's trying to improve you, if they see a
critique
fault.
You.
If they see
criticism.
A fault in me, they say, look, Sayyid, I think, you know, this method is like very effective with kids.
Phrase it differently.
The young people like this, the youth like this. So it's not directly, it's indirectly.
Right.
But I get the hint. You know what I mean?
It's the same way like you are taught to speak to your elders if you want to teach them something, because it is kind of like a hard thing for an elder person to get taught by a younger person. So the younger person is taught to say, I think that this method is maybe better. You say it in a very polite and diplomatic way. We also have this story, if you remember, about the imams, Imam Hussein wal Hassan alayhi salam.
Exactly.
Teaching the old man how to do ritual ablution. They did it. They created a scenario, a fake scenario, where one of the brothers made a mistake and the other brother is telling him, no, do so and so. Instead of just going to the old man being like, my friend, you're completely wrong. You got to do it in a good and polite manner.
Exactly. I mean, like you said, the story that you mentioned was one of the classical stories of the Ahl Bayt alayhi wasalam.
Right,
where they teach you by example. They teach you without having to hurt your feelings. And you get the point and you'll be glad. And, you know, you feel the utmost respect for such a person who tries to teach you and make you feel that there's a room for improvement.
That's, of course, if you're not an arrogant person.
Yeah, and at the same time, they are not direct about it. At the same time, they have not hurt your feeling. So as parents, obviously, the most important thing to us is our kids. So we have to make sure that we do not hurt them without realizing.
And with that, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge, and I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions or comments or some feedback, please, please, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, paristoday.com. Alternatively, if you're not such a big fan of these two methods, old-fashioned methods, you can also find us on the various social media sites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
In the limelight.
All those trillions of dollars consumed in wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A pessimism spawned by corporate elites increasingly consumed by greed, says William Astoria Ryder in an article published under the heading 60 Years of War Making May Yet Result in the Destruction of U.S. Democracy. Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Speaking of George Orwell, America's 60-year war, a losing proposition for the many, proved a distinctly winning one for the few, and that wasn't an accident either. In his book Within a Book in 1984, Orwell wrote all too accurately of permanent war as a calculated way of consuming the products of modern capitalism without generating a higher standard of living for its workers. That, of course, is the definition of win-win situation for the owners. In his words, the essential act of war is destruction, not necessarily of human lives, but of the products of human labor. War is a way of shattering to pieces or pouring into the stratosphere or sinking in the depth of the sea, materials which might otherwise be used to make the masses too comfortable and hence, in the long run, too intelligent. Even when weapons of war are not actually destroyed, their manufacture is still a convenient way of expending labor power without producing anything that can be consumed by the workers. War was a way of making huge sums of money for a few at the expense of the many, who would be left in a state where they simply couldn't fight back or take power, ever. Think of such war production and war making as a legalized form of theft, as Icke recognized in 1953 in his Cross of Iron speech against militarism. The production of weaponry he declared 8 years before he named the military-industrial complex in the U.S. constituted theft from those seeking a better education, affordable health care, safer roads, or indeed any of the fruits of a healthy democracy, attuned to the needs of its workers. And war was also a way to stimulate the economy without stimulating hopes and dreams, a way to create wealth for the few while destroying it for the many. Domestically, the Vietnam War crippled Lyndon Johnson's plans for the Great Society. The high cost of the failed war and of Pentagon budgets that continue to rise today regardless of results are now cited as arguments against Joe Biden's Build Back Better plan. President Franklin D. Roosevelt's new ideal, arguably, would have never been funded if today's vast military-industrial complex, or even the one in Ike's day, had existed in the 1930s. As political theorist Crane Brinton noted in The Anatomy of Revolution, a healthy and growing middle class, equal parts optimistic and opportunistic, is likely to be open to progressive, even revolutionary ideas. But a stagnant, shrinking, or slipping middle class is likely to prove politically reactionary as pessimism replaces optimism and protectionism replaces opportunity. In this sense, the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House was anything but a mystery, and the possibility of an autocratic future no less so. All those trillions of dollars consumed in the wasteful wars have helped foster a creeping pessimism in Americans. A sign of it is the near total absence of the very idea of peace as a shared possibility for the U.S. Most Americans simply take it for granted that war or threats of war having a defined immediate past will define the future as well. As a result, soaring military budgets are seen not as aberrations, nor even as burdensome, but as unavoidable, even desirable, a sign of national seriousness and global material superiority. It should be mind-blowing that despite the wealth being created and often destroyed by the United States and impressive gains in worker productivity, the standard of living for workers hasn't increased significantly since the early 1970s. One thing is certain. It hasn't happened by accident. For those who profit most from it, America's 60-year war has indeed been a resounding success, even if also a colossal failure when it comes to worker prosperity or democracy. This really shouldn't surprise us. As former President James Madison warned Americans so long ago, no nation can protect its freedoms amid constant warfare. Democracies don't die in darkness. They die in and from war. In case you hadn't noticed, evidence of the approaching death of American democracy is all around Americans. It's why so many of Americans are profoundly uneasy. They are, after all, living in a strange new world, worse than that of their parents and grandparents, one whose horizons continue to contract while hope contracts with them. And here's what worries most of all. America's very long war of destruction against relatively weak countries and peoples may be over, or at least reduced to the odd moment of hostilities. But America's leaders, no matter the party, now seem to favor a new Cold War against China and now Russia. Incredibly, the old Cold War produced a win that was so sweet, yet so fleeting that it seems to require a massive do-over. Promoting war may have worked well for the military-industrial complex when the enemy was thousands of miles away with no capacity for hitting the homeland. If a war with China or Russia or both comes to pass, it won't be a long one. And count on one thing. America's leaders, corporate, military, and political won't be able to shrug off the losses by looking at positive balance sheets and profit margins at weapons factories.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for tuning in and thank you for listening to this program for a better life with me, Javed Akbari. Now, brothers and sisters, in this episode, I'm going to discuss with you the another stage of nafs. In the previous two or three episodes, I discussed the different levels of nafs. I talked about the importance of self-knowledge, first of all, and then I talked about nafs-e ammara, and then nafs-e lawama, and then we have the nafs-e mutmainna, which we are going to explore in this stage. Now, nafs-e mutmainna, of course, has been translated as the secure self or the certain self. You know, some people have translated as soul in complete rest and complete satisfaction. There is a verse in the Holy Quran, verse 27 and 28 of Surah Al-Fajr, which you can read, of course, for yourself, but I will read it for you. Ya ayyatuha an-nafs al-mutma'inna irja'i ila rabbiki radiyatan mardiyya. O thou soul, in complete rest and satisfaction, return to your Lord, well pleased with Him, well pleasing Him. So the main point which we are going to talk about and elaborate is an-nafsul mutmainna. Dear brothers and sisters, it's important to know ourselves to understand His relationship to Allah. He who knows himself has known his Lord. This is what we talked in the previous episode. The verse of the Holy Quran, which I just recited, refers to yet another level of nafs, which is nafs mutmainna, or the nafs which is at rest. It is the nafs which is at peace. It is the self or the nafs that has ascended to the first station of development towards intimacy, contentment, and love for Allah. Nafs mutmainna is the nafs whose refinement is attained through increasing commitment and through honest and sincere fulfillment of obligations with respect to the true way. Now, the human soul, the human nafs, at this stage is set on the right path, and it is traversing the path towards perfection, the path towards goodness and virtue. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Nafs-e mutmainna, or the secure self, has entered the pathways, the methods and means of protection and healing through self-examination, resistance and striving and devotion. That is where this nafs-e mutmainna is, because it has come all the way from nafs-e ammara, from nafs-e lawwama to nafs-e mutmainna. You know, it is in a position to examine itself, to heal itself, and to resist, to strive, and to devote. These efforts bear the fruit of certainty in the truth that Allah alone is the actor. Allah alone is the Lord, is the sustainer, and Allah alone is the provider. He is the whole and sole actor. He is the cause and motivator of everything, because there is no God but Him. a new Lord but him. And of course, Allah in all of his actions is merciful and generous. He knows the best interests of the nafs or self. Now this certainty, this itminan, of course, which comes from the nafs, leads to trust in Allah. The self, the nafs, becomes confident that what is with Allah is better and more enduring than whatever is in the position of nafs or in the position of others. So the self becomes secure and ceases to occupy itself with anything other than Allah, the Almighty. So it's occupied with Allah and it rests in peace. It is certain. And that's why it's called nafsi mutma'inna. And of course, the Urafa, the mystics, and of course, Shi'a scholars have gone to a great length explaining this level of nafs. Allama Tabatabai, for example, considers this nafs, nafsi mutma'inna, or maybe the confident soul or nafs, to be one that has attained peace by relying on God. It is satisfied with God's pleasure, and it is satisfied with the ups and downs of life. And these ups and downs of life have no effect on it. Everybody obviously has ups and downs. There are bitter experiences, there are happy experiences. But these experiences have no effect on the nafs. Now, such a person with such a soul, with such a nafs, is in complete servitude and does not deviate from the right path. This is the characteristic of the nafsi mutma'inna, or the secure self. Now you can go, if you understand, of course, tafsir, the Farsi or Arabic, you can go to Al-Mizan, volume 20, page 285. Unfortunately, the tafsir Al-Mizan has not been completely translated. The translation is underway and it is being translated. The first few volumes have been translated thanks to some great scholars who have endeavored to translate this voluminous book, Tafsir, of course. Nafsi mutmainna is the first level of maturity for the self. The heart begins to shine with the light of consciousness. The ego's power begins to shrink so that purity, refinement, clarity, and light dominate the heart. The self begins to show its true attributes that were previously hidden. These are the attributes of servitude, or budiyya, you know, helplessness, ajz, you know. All the power belongs to Allah. And these are attributes of humility, the attribute of poverty, you know, non-attachment, faqr. And these are the attributes of need, ihtiyaj, and annihilation, fana. You know, these are some very concepts which someone who understands and who covers the stages and levels of the nafs reaches a level where he considers himself as someone who is annihilated, and who is completely poor, who is completely helpless, and who considers himself as being a pure servant. Now he is under the command of his human soul, which takes pleasure in following the example of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. He possesses the qualities which Allah praises. He is kind, he is generous, he is patient, he is forgiving, he is sincere, thankful, he is content, and he is at peace. Now, the self is characterized by all these positive attributes at this level of the nafs, and which is why it is at peace. The nafs is constantly remembering Allah, and it is tranquil, it is at peace. Allah bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub. And that's another verse which you can find in the Quran. In short, brothers and sisters, an-nafs al-mutma'inna is the noblest and highest soul compared to other stages, because this soul is, this nafs is always in the truth without the slightest doubt. That's all for this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Massive study shows a long-term substantial rise in risk of cardiovascular disease, including heart attack and stroke, after a SARS-CoV-2 infection, according to an article published in the Nature. This article is titled, Heart Disease Risk Soars After COVID, Even with a Mild Case. Stay tuned for more. Even a mild case of COVID-19 can increase a person's risk of cardiovascular problems for at least a year after diagnosis, a new study shows. Researchers found that rates of many conditions, such as heart failure and stroke, were substantially higher in people who had recovered from COVID-19 than in similar people who hadn't had the disease. What's more, the risk was elevated even for those who were under 65 years of age and lacked risk factors, such as obesity and diabetes. It doesn't matter if you are young or old. It doesn't matter if you smoked or you didn't, says study co-author Ziad Al-Ali at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and the chief of research and development for the Veterans Affairs St. Louis Healthcare System. He added, the risk was there. Al-Ali and his colleagues based their research on an extensive health record database curated by the United States Department of Veterans Affairs. The researchers compared more than 150,000 veterans who survived for at least 30 days after contracting COVID-19 with two groups of uninfected people. A group of more than 5 million people who used the VA medical system during the pandemic, and a similarly sized group that used the system in 2017, before SARS-CoV-2 was circulating. People who had recovered from COVID-19 showed stark increases in 20 cardiovascular problems over the year after infection. For example, they were 52% more likely to have had a stroke than the contemporary control group, meaning that out of every 1,000 people studied, there were around 4 more people in the COVID-19 group than in the control group who experienced stroke. The risk of heart failure increased by 72%, or around 12 more people in the COVID-19 group per 1,000 studied. Hospitalization increases the likelihood of future cardiovascular complications, but even people who avoided hospitalization were at higher risk for many conditions. I'm actually surprised by these findings that cardiovascular complications of COVID can last so long. Hussein Ardhali, a cardiologist at Northwestern University in Chicago, Illinois, wrote in an email to Nature. Because severe disease increased the risk of complications much more than mild disease, Ardhali wrote, it is important that those who are not vaccinated get their vaccine immediately. Ardhali cautions that the study's observational nature comes with some limitations. For example, people in the contemporary control group weren't tested for COVID-19, so it's possible that some of them actually had mild infections, and because the authors considered only VA patients, a group that's predominantly white and male, their results might not translate to all populations. Ardhali and Al-Ali agreed that healthcare providers around the world should be prepared to address an increase in cardiovascular conditions. But with high COVID-19 case counts still straining medical resources, Al-Ali worries that health authorities will delay preparing for the pandemic's aftermath for too long. He said, "We collectively dropped the ball on COVID, and I feel we're about to drop the ball on long COVID."
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah.
Allah, 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 Allah.
Today's wonderful tip, what are the secrets of a tranquil heart and a repetitive recitation when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah.
Allahu Rabbi, la sharika lahu.
So, dear listeners, we are talking about the secrets of a tranquil heart and repetitive recitation as far as strengthening and enhancing and improving our ubudiyah, our servitude to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Now, we know that noble supplications are a very important part in increasing and enhancing our servitude to Allah. But these noble supplications, they must be recited with a tranquil heart. Because if these noble supplications, including our daily prayers, are recited without tranquility, and if they are recited without the calmness of the heart, then they will have no effect upon the heart. And so along these lines, if we recite our noble supplications in haste, in a hurry, or while we are troubled and anxious, or our senses are unbalanced, again, we will have no effect upon our hearts. And the whole purpose of these noble supplications is to be able to increase our ubudiyah. And the way to increase our ubudiyah is, of course, when we have an effect upon the heart and the mind and the soul. And dear friends, if we do not recite these supplications with a tranquil heart, then we will not be able to pass the limits of the mere animal tongue or the mere
ear of the outer body, and rather we won't be able to reach the interior ear and the interior tongue, the tongue of the heart. And furthermore, dear friends, if we do not recite these supplications and we do not recite these prayers with a calmness and tranquility of heart, the truth of these supplications and these prayers will not penetrate and they will not be implemented in the core of our heart. And thus our hearts will remain imperfect and they will not have the image of these supplications within them.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah,
ya Allah, ya Mannan, haqqiq
amani. IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
Ya Allah, ya Rahman, haqqiq amanina, waffiqna fi kulli an fi ma sa'ina. أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير يا الله يا رحمن حقق أماني.
Dear listeners of the program Foresight, my name is Muhammad. Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Khaifin, The Whispered Prayer of the Fearful. Please stay with me. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, lock not toward those who profess your unity the doors of your mercy, and veil not those which you has exalted by its professing your unity. How will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, a heart which has been knotted by its love for you, how will you burn it in the heat of your fires? My God, give me sanctuary from your painful wrath and your mighty anger. O all-loving, O all-kind, O compassionate, O merciful, O compeller, O subduer, O all-forgiver, O all-covering. Deliver me through your mercy from the chastisement of the fire and the disgrace of shame when the good are set apart from the evil. Forms are transformed, terrors terrified. The good doers are brought near, the evil doers taken far. And every soul is paid in full what it has earned, and they shall not be wrong.
يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقاء الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. Now, in continuation to what we were saying, which was this idea that two secrets exist in order to enhance and increase our ubudiyya, one of them being a tranquil heart and the other being repetitive recitation. Now, when it comes to a tranquil heart, we said that if our heart is not tranquil and we do not have a calmness of the heart, then the effects of these supplications and these prayers upon us will be very minimal. But on the other hand, if we have a tranquil heart, a heart which is at ease, without haste and without troubles, these supplications and these prayers will have a great impact upon us. Now, the second thing before we end our program is this idea of repetition. Now, one of the importances and the significances of the repetition of worship and the increase of supplications and invocations is that the heart is regularly affected by them. Of course, if we only repeat or if we only recite these supplications and we only recite these du'as and these prayers once in a while, yes, they might have a certain effect for a very limited time, but when we begin to repeat these recitations and these incantations and this dhikr and these du'as and supplications and prayers, then our heart is constantly affected by these prayers and these supplications. And of course, when we start to repeatedly recite these du'as and these supplications, then slowly our emotions will gradually increase when it comes to these prayers. And of course, when our heart is affected and our emotions are invested, gradually the reality of worship and supplication becomes a part of our heart, our mind, and our soul.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said, "Inna sam'a wal basara wal fu'ada kullu ula'ika kana anhu mas'ula." The sound itself, the sight itself, and the heart itself, all of them man has been made responsible for. Allah begins with hearing because hearing is the most difficult to guard. I came into New York City, and I'll tell you something. Going from Mecca to Jeddah was like going from paradise to the gates of paradise. Going from Jeddah to Morocco was like going to a place where I could see paradise off in the distance, but I definitely wasn't in it. And then getting to New York was like a descent into the bowels of hell. And there's no exaggeration about that. Because suddenly, everybody around me was using foul language. It's unbelievable. The only time they don't use foul language is if they're serving you something. Everybody, I was standing in the waiting for the bus, and I hear this two people talking, and I wanted to plug my ears. And these people, it was so foul, every other word was a foul language. And the mu'min is laysa bi bidha in the hadith. The mu'min does not use foul language, nor should he hear it. You have to protect, because now those words ring in the heart. They ring. They have a resonance because you're hearing filth. And you get polluted by it. So you have to guard the ears. And the problem, the danger of the ear is that it's aural. It's circular. It's not linear. The eye, you can divert your gaze. If you see something haram, you can look away. Allah has given the ability with the ear. And this is why in the Quran, Allah always mentions the ear first. Because the ear is more difficult, and the ear is a faster and more direct line to the heart than the eye itself. And then you have to guard the eye, because the eye is a mirror. It's a window into the heart. The eye is a window into the heart. But first and foremost, the heart itself is more important than anything else that the human being has been given. And so we have to purify our hearts.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Mali's government recently expelled France's ambassador, the latest sign of mounting tensions between the West African country and its former colonial power. The move came after outrageous remarks by French Foreign Minister who claimed that Mali's government is out of control and illegitimate. Now, Mali's foreign minister, Abdoulaye Diop, appeared on the country's national TV to announce the expulsion of the French ambassador.
French ambassador Joël Meyer has not been declared persona non grata, but the government of Mali wished for him to leave the territory within 72 hours for reasons related to the outrageous statements that were made against the transitional authorities, which we found unacceptable and which we have rejected.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the expulsion of France's ambassador to Mali amid worsening ties between the two countries. Tensions have been building up between the two sides as Mali seeks to assert its independence while France is desperate to maintain its grip on its former colony. In the second part of our program, we'll have a guest here in the studio who will be telling us more about increased trade ties between Iran and African countries. So stay tuned with us until the end of our show.
France unwanted in Mali. France's ambassador to Mali has been kicked out of the country in a major blow to his neo-colonial influence in this country and the whole region. The major reason for this move is the undiplomatic, insulting remarks by French authorities towards a new military government in Mali. The root of the current tensions goes back to 2012, when France deployed its forces in overwhelmingly Muslim Mali to allegedly fight militants and terrorists. Years after this deployment, terrorists continue to wreak havoc in the country, leaving thousands dead and over a million displaced. This growing insecurity has turned the public opinion massively against France.
Polls show that 80% of Malians in the capital Bamako think France sent troops in the country to protect its economic interests. Most people in Mali are strongly supportive of expelling the French ambassador and are also demanding now the withdrawal of French troops. Now, for an incisive analysis on the worsening tensions between France and Mali, we contacted Moussa Traoré, a Malian academic and political analyst who is also the founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Now, France has, over the last few months, been brazenly interfering in Mali's internal affairs. Mr. Traoré, was the expulsion of France's ambassador long overdue?
I think this is something that the people of Mali were expecting for a long time. They were even asking themselves questions about why the Malian government, those in power, were not reacting. So, in fact, it seems that the president and the prime minister of Mali just did what the people were asking. And this has been the case since the second coup. Since the second coup, if you analyze it, each move that was made by the government was made because the people were asking it.
Over the past few months, French officials made a series of outrageous and hostile comments about Mali's transitional government. The government in Bamako remained patient, hoping the leaders in Paris would get back to their senses, but the following remarks by France's foreign minister angered Malian authorities, leading to the expulsion of the ambassador. Let's take a listen.
It's a new sign of recklessness. This junta is illegitimate and it's taking irresponsible measures.
After those insulting remarks, this was the immediate reaction of Mali's foreign minister.
Insults aren't proof of greatness. We are willing to discuss with France or others on serious matters. This isn't about being irresponsible. What we are trying to do is defend the interests of our country.
Over the years, France has backed and collaborated with military rulers in Africa. So why are the authorities in France hostile to the current leadership in Mali?
Here there is a double standard, if we analyze it. And the reason why this time the French do not accept the fact that we have the military in power is because the military now is working for the people of Mali. They want to strengthen the power of the military, get more independent, and this is why it's disturbing Paris. Also, the military was able to buy new weapons from the Russians using the gold they have. What the government did, they went directly to the Russians saying, okay, we have gold, you just come here, get the gold, in exchange you give us brand new weapons. So this is a revolution. If you look at this part of Africa, what usually happens is that they go to see France, and France at the last minute says, no, do not buy them from the Russians or the Americans, just buy it from us. And they give very old equipment to the Malians, to the Africans. This is what most African countries are used to. And this is one fact. The military in most African countries is so weak.
Now, many believe the real reason behind the decision by France to continue risking the lives of its troops in a faraway country is to protect French economic and geostrategic interests, namely its exploitation of gold and uranium mines in the region. Additionally, France has been previously accused of backing Tuareg separatists in Mali. Now, Mr. Traoré, what is really at stake if France loses its neocolonial control over Mali?
If France loses its power in this region of Africa, this is the beginning of the end of the French power. We all know that in France there are no resources, there's no oil. In terms of manufacturing, France is not a big country. In terms of agriculture, the French agriculture relies more on the subsidies from the EU. So it means now that's going to be the end of the French power And this is going to be very problematic. If we look at, let's say, welfare state that France represents today, it is because we are exploiting, taking the resources from the African continent and making the Africans from Africa starve. And this is what explains the wealth of France. So this is the end of the French power.
Terrorists and militant groups have gone on a killing spree crossing Mali and other parts of the Sahel. Currently,